Well, hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. My friend and colleague, Lou Padgett, has returned to this program. It's been a little too long, and but she is a frequent guest, usually, including going way back to Hawaii when I had a show there. So I think that was in about 2002. Welcome to the program, Lou Padgett.
Thank you, Diana. Good to be back.
Yes, it's good to have you back. Lou is the author of 5 books, and you can read about them on her website, loupaget.com. And Lou is also a ASECT certified sex educator. She's an international best-selling author and entrepreneur of 5 books, which have been translated into 28 languages. Maybe it's more by now. But anyway, 28 languages is pretty good, and represented in over 60 countries with over 3 million copies sold. And Lou is a good writer, and your books are really fun and so informative. You deliver information about sexuality and relationships with lots of accuracy and fun.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So
that was the quest when I was writing them, that the information give people, make them feel good, validate what they were looking for. In some ways, they may go like, oh, that's exactly how I was feeling. And then give them a range of other things that they might consider that have come from people that really knew what worked for them as well.
And you do it very well. You've got your 5 books. So it's How to Be a Great Lover, right?
Yeah, and just to give the listeners a little bit of background, when I started writing my books, the real impetus was because I had been doing an instructional hands-on seminar series in the area of manual and oral techniques. And that stemmed from my having been a volunteer on the AIDS ward here in Los Angeles at Cedars-Sinai Hospital.
And you did that for 11 years, I read in your biography.
Mm-hmm. I volunteered, and then when I started getting too busy with my lecturing and traveling, that's when I stopped volunteering there. But what I found is that even though we were talking about, you know, that it was the Immune Disorder Center, which in essence was the AIDS ward, what I realized is the majority of people really weren't talking about sexual health or how to keep themselves safe. So I thought, okay, I can't be the only one looking for this information. And I started looking for, I was a student in New York when all of the AIDS stuff first broke open. So I realized I was a sexual being and I was likely going to be sexual, but I wanted to do it safely. So I wanted to know what other people really knew worked for them. I didn't want to do things with a gazillion people, but I wanted to know what a gazillion people knew.
Right.
So that was my thing. I started asking people, tell me what's the best thing you've ever done with someone. And I will say initially they were like, what are you talking about? I said, no. Looking at the typical sources then, and this was, almost 20 years ago, I mean, really the only source was the adult industry, which is in large part just a hopeless source of information about women's bodies and pleasure and what really worked for women. So,
yes, it's sex entertainment. It's not education at all.
Thank you. I mean, it is something that is for people to masturbate to, self-pleasure, whatever term you'd like to use. That's what it's designed for. And it's someone else's fantasy of what they like, not necessarily what someone else likes.
Yes.
So I looked at that and I went, okay, this is not helpful. So that's when I started asking real people what really worked for them.
Mm-hmm.
And as I tell people, invariably it would be after a couple of adult beverages. And then people would share with me what worked for them. And having a hard sciences background, as I say, it's all the good stuff, biology, botany, microbiology, zoology. I would listen. It's like when you speak with a patient, Diana, or you have a client who comes in, you know when someone is trying to, use smoke and mirrors, or they don't really know what they're talking about, but they're trying to act like they do. You know that. You just have like that, the little spidey sense or whatever it is. Same thing for
me.
I appreciate it.
Well, if people are nervous in their first session with me, I say this is the place to be yourself. I assure you it's a safe place for you to express your feelings and what's going on for you. And it's not a place to do the smoke and mirrors because they're paying good money to get some help.
Right, and the faster you get to what's really going on, the faster things can get addressed.
Right, exactly.
So what I found was I knew when someone was trying to market themselves or sell themselves as, you know, I'm so amazing, let me tell you how awesome I am. Because that's usually what we find culturally.
Yes.
Is that the people who want to market themselves and make themselves more desirable, they will tell you how amazing they are at something sexual, which I would be like, I don't know. You know, something's not ringing right here. But I would know when someone was saying something from a physiological standpoint that it would or should work. So that was the impetus behind the seminars. The books came out of the seminars because people said you have so much information. You crammed all of this information. You got to write a book. And I didn't intend on writing a book. As a matter of fact, you know, my English class, the only English class I took in university, I got an F. The reason I got an F is that I didn't do the assignments. It's a bit difficult to
get grades. Yeah, I was going to say, because you're a good writer, and you're a smart cookie. So it's surprising you got an F, but as you said, you didn't do the assignments.
This is true confession. And I had a crush on a guy who was in the class, and then I realized very soon after I registered in the class, this is not going to, no connection here. And I wasn't responsible enough to drop the class. So that was, so, you know, learning going forward. But what I did is that I wanted real people examples of what worked. I put them into the seminar series. The seminars became the books. And then I became an ASECT certified sex educator. Most people will get that by doing a master's or PhD program. I did it by what they refer to as special circumstances. And for me, that was a contributing body of knowledge as a result of having two international best-selling. My first two books were massive international bestsellers. So
wonderful. And that was How to Be a Great Lover.
And How to Give Her Absolute Pleasure.
Yes, and How to Give Her Absolute Pleasure, totally explicit techniques every woman wants her man to know.
Right. So the How to Be a Great Lover, girlfriend to girlfriend, totally explicit techniques that will blow his mind. That was my first book from the ladies' seminar. And the men's seminar, the book that came from that is How to Give Her Absolute Pleasure. And the reason that the books were so popular is this is the first time that sexuality had been presented not as someone else's experience, because you and I both know that when we're talking about sexuality, the thing that people want to know is they want the information and is it applicable for them. They really don't want to know what someone else does, you know? They don't want to know what, you know, what this person who's talking to them says, well, I do this. Well, that's nice. But first off, it detracts from the person having the focus of attention be about information that will work for them. They're imagining that person doing something at that point, which is hardly helpful. But what I found is I would give them the information. It's like a buffet of ideas. And then the books were also illustrated step by step for the different techniques. So that's what really...
And the illustrations are clear. Some illustrations and some books aren't.
Well, what I wanted to do is that I wanted them to be line drawings so that when people looked at them, they didn't go like this, oh my God, that's a body, or oh my God, that's a penis. And I wanted it to be that they could see it was representative, and that they could imagine themselves doing it. So
didn't you have a really close gay friend named Brian who had some great ideas for performing fellatio?
Yes. Absolutely. Brian was my best friend who I remember going over to his home, and he had a new tennis bracelet. Mm-hmm. So tennis bracelets were really big. And it was 1-carat diamond stones all the way around. So this was a serious piece of bling.
Really?
Yes. And he was like, woohoo! And I looked at this. So this was 11 o'clock in the morning. And I looked at this and I said, where did you get that? Mm-hmm. And he said, I got it from Donnie, who was his partner. And I said, well, I know it's not your birthday. I said, why did you get it? He said, oh, because I get such great head. And I went, what? I thought, really? And he goes, where else do you think I get my bijoux from? And I was like, I have no idea. He said, and then all of a sudden it was like a light bulb went off. And I went, okay, you're gay, you're male, you give them, you receive them, you brag, you're so damn good. Show me what you do. Tell me what you do. So I'm having a tall latte. He said, okay, take your spoon out of your latte. I took my spoon out. And on that spoon, Brian proceeded to show me hand techniques, throat techniques, tongue techniques, you name it. Yeah. As I say, it's still the best latte that I've ever had. And what he did.
And all these years later, you're still remembering it very fondly.
Exactly. Well, and Brian died probably 15 years ago of AIDS. And
how tragic. He was,
yeah, I mean,
for you,
he was
such
fabulous,
a dear friend.
And I dedicated my first book to him.
I remember that, Lou. Yes.
Yeah. And I called up his mom, and I told his mom I was dedicating my book to him.
Yeah.
And we both had a good cry. And for years, Brian, I would carry a picture of Brian into my seminars, and I would say, this is the only man who's allowed to come into the ladies' seminar.
I love it.
So the most popular manual technique that is taught in the ladies' seminar is Ode to Brian.
Ode to Brian. Yes, I remember that in your book, too.
Yeah, so that's, you know, I look for information wherever I'm going to get. And like when I was starting the men's seminars, my older sister's gay, so I've never been with a woman. I mean, I can get information, but I wanted real people information that told me, this is why this is important, this is why this is important. So the first thing I did, I called up my older sister and I said, okay, I'm going to be doing a men's seminar. I need to know, what do I need to know about being with a woman, going down on a woman? What do I need to know? And so she walked me through very matter-of-factly the things that, you know, she knew from her friends and from her relationships. And again, I'm smart enough to know when I don't know, and I go and find someone who does.
That makes you a superb researcher. And Lou, I didn't have a chance to ask you this off the air, but on one of your previous appearances on Love, Lust, and Laughter, you offered to send to the first caller one of your books. Is that still a possibility?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, so let me say to the listeners then, and of course you obviously have to be a live listener, and many of you I know listen to the archive version, but if you want to ask Lou Padgett a question, or myself, or both of us, then you need to call 888-874-4888, and Jesse, who is on our board this evening, will take your name. He'll probably do a little bit of pre-screening and then he'll let me know that you're on the line. And then you need to stay on this is only for the first caller. And what book might you send to this first caller? Which one?
It would really depend. It may be the couple's book, which is The Great Lover Playbook.
And that's been very popular, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
if you are a caller, the first caller, with a question for Lou Padgett or possibly Dr. Diana, then you need to stay on the line after you've asked the question and heard your answer, because Jesse will come back and get your mailing address. And then I'll get it to Lou Padgett.
Yeah.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Then it can be sent to me, and it can be sent from my office.
Yes, which is in Los Angeles. And I will never forget when you came on my show when I was in Honolulu. So this is about 2002, maybe. We had a man call in from mm-hmm. one of the neighboring islands, and he was in tears because he was experiencing ED, and he loved his wife. Do you remember that call? It was just so poignant.
I do, and he was so worried about, you know, that he'd never been able to talk to anybody about this.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been going on. The pain you could feel, just the absolute sadness and pain, it
right.
literally was palpable. And
right.
he'd not been able to talk to anyone about, was he going to be okay? Were they going to be okay?
And, precisely.
And it was something that, and Diana, you and I speak about this, that there are times when we really don't know how we're going to be impacting people. And that's why one of the most important things that we have to do is always to be as clear and clean about our intention when we're delivering information, particularly in the area of sexuality. Because there's
yes.
so often it is a time and an when people are asking these questions, they're very vulnerable. They
yes.
really haven't been given accurate information. And many times people have been so shamed and so judged about anything in the area of sexuality that they literally, I mean, many therapists don't get any training in the area of sexuality at all.
Unless they're board certified or ASEX certified sex therapists. And I, of course, am, but you're right. I hear from often new clients that they've been to a therapist who, you know, the elephant in the room was that they're having a miserable sex life, but the therapist didn't deal with it much because he or she felt inadequate. They didn't have the training to deal with it. So the smart therapist, and I get referrals from therapists who, you know, are general therapists, relationship therapists, but not trained in sexuality. So I get referrals from those therapists, and of course that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Again, and, when you know but you don't know, and you make
right.
sure someone can take care of it. I mean, and that's what experts should be doing. They should be
yeah.
referring to someone who they know is an expert, and not try
yeah.
and bluff their way through it.
Yes.
Which
so,
often, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I wanted to shift our conversation a little bit because
mm-hmm.
we saw each other again, and we haven't seen each other for a while, and it was in Seattle where I live, and you
mm-hmm.
had come up from Los Angeles, and it was a meeting for the program of human sexuality from the University of Minnesota, and PHS, Program of Human Sexuality, and I was delighted to see you. It jogged my memory that it's been a little too long since I've had you on the show, and because I just adore you, Lou, and you're such a you have so much information, and you're such a good media guest. In fact, you have your own radio program on Mondays, and I'm going to be your guest. I guess it's this coming Monday.
That's
is that
correct.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is correct. My radio show is Sex Talk with Lou, and it is on TogiNet Radio. But if you just type in to a URL, Sex Talk with Lou, it should come up and you'll be able to get to the station and to the listings. And they're all, you know, again, like anything else, the majority of people do listen when they have the time, when they're driving somewhere, whatever.
Right.
And,
right.
and again, but they do listen to an archived version.
Right. Your show is done live? No, it's only archived.
No, I do. It's done live. But
okay,
I mean,
good.
Sometimes people call in live, but it is definitely it's archived as well.
Right.
And so, I mean, I will talk. The one thing that's great about being able to do an online show is that you can cover things that maybe a lot of other people will not. Now, the other thing I say to people is, look, if I can't say it in a nice way, I have an umbrella policy about delivering information about sexuality.
Yes.
If it doesn't work, if I cannot validate the information, you know, either scientifically or anecdotally. So it has to work. I have to be able to validate it. And it has to make people feel good. If it falls outside of those three parameters, I don't talk about it.
Perfect.
I mean, we could go on and on about making judgment about someone doing this or judgment of someone doing something about that. What we really have to do in the area of sexuality is very discerning. And the reason I was in Seattle is that I am the chair for the Leadership Council. And what the Leadership Council does for the program of human sexuality at
the
University of Minnesota.
That was my segue so we could talk about that. So
okay.
You're chair for them.
Correct.
And you and Eli Coleman are... You're such a beautiful woman. Your picture together, I'm looking at it now, page 17 of the magazine, Advancing Sexual Health. So you're the chair, and go on about the program, because I just want to say, so our listeners know, the reason I was at this meeting is that I have supported this program, including financially, since, I think, 2003, when I lived in Los Angeles.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And Eli Coleman has been a longtime friend of mine, and he's doing
Eli,
a magnificent
yeah.
job. But tell us about, so you're the chair of the leadership.
Leadership Council. And what
Council.
The Leadership Council does is we're kind of like a brain trust and a group of people who have, you know, influencers, connections, and people who have a passion and a focus about sexual health from a range of different perspectives. And we look to raise money to support the actual endowed chairs. So what an endowed chair is, and when Eli first approached me about being part of the Leadership Council, I didn't have a clue what a chair was, what a endowed chair was, because I'm not in the world of universities. I'm not in the world of secondary education. So what an endowed chair is a chair that literally has like its own trust fund that funds the salary and the scholarly pursuits of a scholar's work. So it may be a lab, it could be studies, it could be something. So it allows that seated scholar of that endowed chair, so people will know that there's an endowed chair in cardiac health or in physiology or in, you know, retinal studies. I mean, there's an endowed chair for truly, honest to God, like endoplasmic reticulum. I mean, it's just for every possible area of the body. What there has never been, however, until the endowed chair through the program in human sexuality, there's never been an endowed chair in sexual health in the U.S., ever.
Yes, I remember that, and that's why this program is so revolutionary. And what has been raised so far?
Well, at this point, each chair is a $2 million commitment, and the funding has to be there and invested into the main investment accounts of the university before it will start funding and they can start looking for a scholar. So we now have two endowed chairs. One, the seated scholar is Dr. Eli Coleman.
Right.
And that's chair in sexual health. Then we have the Dr. Joycelyn Elders chair in sexual health education. And Dr. Joycelyn was the former Surgeon General of the U.S. She came from Arkansas. And the reason she had a tie to the University of Minnesota is as a young pediatric resident, University of Minnesota was only one of two places that would offer a young black female a residency. And she was there for a year, but she'd already fallen in love, so she ended up going back to Arkansas. And she, you know, married her husband, and they have, you know, two sons. But what Joycelyn did is she was willing to lend her name to this endowed chair. And the seated scholar for it now is Dr. Michael Ross, who literally has like 11 degrees, and he is one of the smartest, savviest, and when it comes to knowing sexual health education worldwide, honestly, I was out of my mind ecstatic when I found out that Mike Ross had accepted that position, because truly, I mean, he has forgotten more than the majority of people will ever learn about sexual health education.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, he knows it from an Australian standpoint, from a Northern European standpoint, from an African standpoint, from North American standpoint, South American standpoint, and he has a passion about this. So the second seated chair for the Joycelyn Elders Chair is Dr. Michael Ross, and he came from Austin, Texas, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Now, what we are looking at now is we are, whether it is a chair in aging or of transgender, because transgender is a hugely hot topic right now.
But very
what
hot.
We can what we can also do from a funding standpoint, we currently have, I believe it is, all I have to do is just look at my little numbers in my little book here. I believe we have $7 million that has been raised en route to $10 million for the first endowed chair. And we have, you know, let me see, Joycelyn Elders Chair, we have $3.3 million, which that's not too shabby. Not at all. So we had a major donation that, again, I think it's $7 million that has been committed, but there's only, at this point, $3.7 million, $3.8 million that has been collected. Some of these donations are over a period of time, over 5 years.
Yes.
So the big thing about this is that we also have a range of other ways, and the reason that endowed chairs are so important, I need to point this out, a lot of universities now, when there is a tenured track, meaning when there is a secure professorship position, that tenured track, when the person retires or if they die, it goes like this. Poof, it disappears. And what Eli was seeing is that there were two or three different programs where the person either retired or one person died, and their whole body of scholarly information in the area of sexuality and their training and everything evaporated, and they were not replaced. There was no other scholar or professor coming in to deliver that information.
To continue on with the research
and this body of knowledge. Correct.
And
the majority of universities now are cutting back on all kinds of things. So constantly there's no money coming in for this. They're having to cut budgets here. They're having to cut there. So having this endowed chair is hugely, hugely impactful in maintaining the scholarly research and the public policy, all of the things that are important to maintain a sexually healthy society. And as Joycelyn Elders says, her main focus in sexual health education is really about breaking the back of poverty. Because Arkansas has one of the highest teen pregnancy rates. And as she said,
yes.
She
grew up, and she grew up
exactly,
very poor.
Very poor. She was the eldest of, I think, was it 9 children?
Yeah, something like that. She spoke, as she always does, so passionately and eloquently, and she just inspires others. And I can see why Bill Clinton hired her, and then under pressure he had to fire her.
Well,
that's really too bad.
Right. And it really, what the question that people say that she said that the Dr. Elder said masturbation should be taught in school, that wasn't what she said. It was completely taken out of context.
Yeah.
But anyways, what Joycelyn said is that she watched, she said, these bright young minds, and she said these girls would get pregnant, and she said, she wants to break the back of poverty with sexual health education, because she said poverty is about babies having babies. And
that's
she said,
right.
When they get locked into that, she said there really isn't any way you know, for them to get out of it. At that point, they then have a baby to take care of.
Yeah.
And so when, and Michael Ross was hilarious. We just had our retreat meeting up at Dr. Pepper Schwartz's at
yes.
her ranch. And
which is a spectacular place, isn't it?
You know, it's just quite marvelous.
Yes.
And Dr. Pepper, and some of you may know her from the show Married at First Sight, or know her from University of Washington, or AARP, because she writes about sexuality and relationships.
In yeah, she's their ambassador for relationships mm-hmm. and sexuality.
And
yes.
Mm-hmm. And what we were doing is looking at the most important thing that we can do is to create our next wave of synergy and energy, and having people in the Northwest. This is the first time we had spoken in that area, and to have Dr. Elders be there, she is so passionate. And as Michael said, I don't have to tell anybody who Joycelyn Elders is. He said, I'm the Joycelyn Elders scholar. He said, I don't have to say anything else after that. He said, it's not like saying, you know, Bill and Rosemary Green chair in, and people go, well, who is Bill and Rosemary Green? Everyone knows who Joycelyn is, and she is such an icon for
right.
so many who have gone into the area of sexual health, that, and she's so approachable and just absolutely lovely. So we are very lucky to have her be on our leadership council, and interestingly enough, as a result of the University of Minnesota creating the Elders Chair, there was another chair that was named in her honor at the University of Arkansas.
Oh, I did not know that. That's wonderful. So there was a synergistic kind of, or a mm-hmm. ripple effect anyway.
Correct. I mean, there's no mention in there of sexuality. However, it is a chair named for Dr. Elders. And she is, when she was, her practice was as a pediatric endocrinologist. So
mm-hmm.
she saw a lot of things when she was overseas as a young physician that we typically do not see here, because doctors will often try and change or would try and fix someone's ambiguous genitalia. She would see all of these things. So she knew in looking at, and from most people probably know, endocrinology is the study of the endocrine glands. And your endocrine glands are the things that really, you know, your the testes and ovaries, those are considered part of endocrine glands. And they are things that govern so much of what impacts our body and our health on a daily basis. And, you know, another council that I was on was the National Leadership Council with former Surgeon General David Satcher. And what David looked at was that it was more important to, we need to talk about sexual health. Health is sexual health. And that's what we're looking for. And he did the Surgeon General's call to action about sexual health when he was Surgeon General. Because, I mean, and Dr. Elders, you know, the figures are just staggering. How much money gets spent out of the, it's like 30% of the health care monies that get spent are spent on women taking care of their sexual health.
30%.
I don't even have the exact number, but it was so huge, I could not believe it. And
so how does that break down, women taking care of their own?
That I don't know. But what
okay.
I do know is that often what will happen in the area of sexual health, people will not address something when they are at the doctor, or the doctor will not ask them correctly. And I know from being on this leadership council, being in part of the National Advisory Council, I know that one of the biggest things that is not taught in medical school is anything to do with sexual function, sexual health, and if it is, it might be 4 hours, maybe 8 hours.
That's
in
right.
4 years of med school, and it is often optional. It
yep.
would be, so really the only thing that people are going to do is they're going to go to classes, because in med school they are taught to the test. There's no question. I do a presentation at UCLA every year.
Yes.
And I
mm-hmm.
asked this year, I said, let me ask you something. And these are for PhDs, for MD psychiatric residents, and for marriage family therapists.
Right.
And I said to the residents, I said, let me ask you something, and to the professors that were there. Is everything still just being taught to the test? And they looked very sheepish, and they just sort of nodded. So unless it's on a test, they don't get taught about it. And here's the big thing. Your sexuality is, I mean, let's be honest. You came from sexuality. You arrive on this planet, and you get assigned a sex. Everything about you and your whole life is about having you as who you identify, what you feel about yourself, that be taken care of and be respected and be acknowledged. And we don't even talk about it accurately in schools. I mean, it is patently absurd. We keep talking about, you know, abstinence only. Well, let's be honest. Abstinence can work for a lot of things. You might abstain from drinking alcohol. You might abstain from smoking. Or you might abstain from, you know, gambling or whatever it may be. But abstinence in information only about sexuality, what we do know, those programs, any school that has an abstinence-only program, they have the highest rates of teenage pregnancies, and they have the highest rates of sexually transmitted infections.
And it's pretty shocking, because the United States has the highest of mm-hmm. the well-developed countries, the highest amount of teenage pregnancies.
Teenage pregnancies.
And, you know, compare our teenage pregnancies to, say, that in the Scandinavian countries. Oh, it's kind of shameful. Back in 1985, I was sent by the Junior League of Palo Alto back to St. Louis, and St. Louis had the St. Louis Junior League had a really good avoiding teenage pregnancy program. And there were a lot of and they were mostly black girls who had been through the program and had avoided sexuality, or had avoided pregnancy. They were there praising the program because the program gave them some extra self-esteem and ways mm-hmm. to avoid teenage pregnancy. And that's, as Dr. Elder says, that is the thing that creates poverty, because it derails these girls. They can't get an education then, and their children having children.
Babies having babies. And, you know, one of the things that I think many people do not realize about Junior League is, because I was in Junior League in both Calgary and in New York, is that Junior League will see a need within a community, they will mm-hmm. build a program, and then within 2 years, they will turn that program back over to the community and have it be run by the community. So people
That's right.
who think that Junior League, these women stand around in, you know, sweater sets with pearls and sip, you know, champagne cocktails, couldn't be further from the truth. And there's so many things like mother's breast milk in hospitals, so many of the programs that are in schools that talk about diversity or talk about disability or talk about all kinds of different things that come in. These are programs that all got started within Junior League. And Junior League didn't stand there and say, we need to be given credit.
No, I know. I was involved in a number of those programs. I'm still in the Junior League now in Seattle, but of course I'm a sustainer, so I don't do a lot. But the thing about Junior League is it teaches people how to be effective volunteers. And there were
Correct.
A lot of programs, especially when I was active in Palo Alto, that did go out on their own, a child advocacy council that taught teachers how to train children about sexual abuse and avoiding that. And then they go out on their own. So it's a good organization. So let us go. We're not going to get through our whole program, so I'm hoping you can come back for a part two soon.
I am it. do we
this
ever...
always happens to us. You know, we have a lot to say.
And then we go off on another little tangent somewhere.
All right, so sex as we age.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about that. I missed the beginning of the Seattle PHS meeting because I got lost.
Well, that was not an easy place to find.
It was not, and I've lived here 7 years, and I still get lost. And it was, you know, it was dark, and the street signs weren't good. And apparently, Pepper Schwartz opened the program. I know she organized it along with the couple that provided
correct.
The lovely home for our meeting.
With the Battalias. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the Battalias. And so
Heather and Mike.
She pointed out that that most studies have a cutoff at age 60 and
mm-hmm.
making assumptions about older life sexuality. So I know Pepper. I've known Pepper a long, long time. But what did she say about it? And I want to talk a little bit after you give us update about her AARP article.
Right. She didn't go into a lot of depth on it.
Yeah.
But if people want to see some of the things that she writes about in the area of, you know, aging and sexuality, she does have a post on Facebook right now that as people are getting older, there's more divorces. And I certainly am seeing that as well, that people are no longer like, you have to stay together for forever. But I didn't get a chance to read it. I was going over some other things, but the one thing that she did say, and this is from a study that she had done, I don't know if it was sponsored by AARP, but she was presenting the results in San Francisco. I believe it was a Quad-S meeting in San Francisco. And one of the things that was very interesting is that even with aging, for many couples, if there is an illness or if there is something from a health standpoint, that often is something that will truncate, interrupt, or stop them being intimate or being sexual. But the one cultural group, self-identified cultural group, where it didn't matter whether they were sick or if this was going on or if that was going on, they were still being sexually active. And that was the people who identified as being Hispanic.
Yes.
They're like, we're still going to take care of this part of ourselves.
Yes. Pepper has written something like 19 books, and she's been on this program several times. And The New Normal, her recent book that she did with two other people, was an international survey of people, and Hispanics and even people in Spain, so some of the Latins, they tend to identify their spouses as passionate lovers, not just good friends, as they age. So that helps a lot.
You know, when I first got into this field, one of the people who was a mentor to me was Bernie Zilbergeld.
Oh, yes, and I know. I remember seeing you. I've had conversations with him, but I remember toward the end of his life seeing you in deep conversations with Bernie at Quad-S meeting or an ASEC meeting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he always, you know, some people may have found him curmudgeonly, but I was like this, kind of like this little spark.
Sure.
He was always so helpful for me. And the reason I entitled my book, The Great Lover Playbook, is, and that was originally the subtitle, the original title was 365 Days of Sensational Sex, The Great Lover Playbook, is because I remember him talking about what great lovers do. And he said that it doesn't matter what their age is. He said what is really important is how they feel their sexuality is. And he said some of the people who I speak with who are in their 70s, their 80s, you know, some, you know, in their 90s, they still consider themselves to be great lovers because of the intimacy that they connect with. And it isn't about intercourse. It is about
of course not.
How they can make one another feel. And
It's about emotional intimacy and even physical intimacy. But if the emotional connection is there, then the physical intimacy is deeper.
Right. And here's what I also tell people. It's like, look, please stop comparing yourself to what you think everybody else is doing. And when I get asked the question, so what's the average number of times people are having sex in a month? I say, I'm not going to answer the question. And they'll go, why not? I said, because the moment I give an answer, someone out there is going to get beaten up.
Right.
Someone's going to be told they didn't do enough, they're wanting too much, someone will be judged. And as I said in the very beginning, you know, we were talking, this is about discernment and being gentle with people. And whatever is normal for one couple is normal for them.
Exactly. And I get that question, of course, in my practice, especially in the first session, what's normal? And I answer it in a similar way. And, of course, I don't see the people that might only have sex twice a year and they're happy with it. I see the people where mismatched desire, where, it's often the man who wants more, but sometimes it's the woman, more sex. And so when they're unhappy is when I see them. There are, however, some studies that have been done in some journals. The American Journal of Cardiology revealed that men who engaged in intercourse at least twice a week were a staggering 45% less likely to suffer a heart attack than those who had sex once a month or less. We do know that sex can improve heart health, and that's relevant to aging. And I have one more little tidbit here because I love this one. In 2010, Brazil's Minister of Health made a surprising recommendation, and what he did was to encourage Brazilians to have sex 5 times a week, and this would be as a countermeasure to the nation's hypertension epidemic. So here, Brazilians are having a lot of hypertension. So he's saying, well, go out and have sex 5 times a week.
You know, and then that'll cure all of your financial stress.
It actually, having sex can reduce stress. A Swedish study, this was published in the Journal of Economics, and it said that couples that increased their sexual romps to 1 time a week had so much more happiness that it was the equivalent of having like a $50,000 raise. And I don't know exactly how they measured that, but anyway, it does reduce stress, and part of it is the release of oxytocin, that sexual activity helps relieve pains and migraines, and then the oxytocin is what's helping when two couples are touching each other, and even oxytocin is especially in female orgasm, as you know. And then, so they have more relaxation and sounder sleep, and improved sleep, of course, lends itself to reduced body weight and lower stress and increased immunity and overall well-being. So there are lots of health benefits to good sex.
Yeah, well, for some people, particularly men, an orgasm is, you know, like a sedative.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, you know, usually it's, you know, a darkened room, or, you know, you're ready to go horizontal at some point, and it's just kind of like, okay. And I remember this one woman saying to her husband, he says, well, why can't you do something for her? She goes, look, do I have a big N on my forehead for night hall, which was a sleep thing? And he was like, well, it really helps me go to sleep. She's like, oh, please. But
no, it is true that for many men, not all, but for many, probably for most men, when they ejaculate, have their orgasm, it's like a sleep thing. It seems that, and maybe this would be a good segue into speaking about sex and aging a little more.
Right. But that's again, what I'm just going to do the same thing.
We're not going to have time, so I'll have to lure you into coming back for a part two soon. So this is about sex promoting healthier aging for men and for women. So in this one study, there was a group of men being treated for erectile problems. And so these men saw greater increases in testosterone when, along with the other treatments, they had frequent sex. And so men who had sex at least 8 times per month had a greater increase than those who had a better outcome with erectile dysfunction than those who had sex less than 8 times per month. And then, so that's on the male side, and then menopausal women experienced in this one study fewer hot flashes when they had sex more frequently. And I know this way back when personally, and then I hear about it clinically too. And it may be because sexual activity helps regulate hormonal levels, and that makes sense.
Yeah, and just the whole hormonal cascade. So
yeah.
There isn't as much as the peaks and the troughs with the drop-off of the progesterone, drop-off of the estrogen, and then it, you know, feels that's when, you know, the hot flash spikes will occur. Let me ask you a question, Diana.
Sure.
Are you seeing more young men coming into your practice who are dealing with ED, erectile dysfunction?
Yes, yes. And the first thing I do is to make sure that they have you been checked out by a doctor, specifically a urologist. And sometimes they have. Other times they haven't. And they need to have, if they haven't, they need to see the doctor. Because I want to rule out physiological stuff. But almost always when the man is young, it's performance anxiety. And sometimes it's a partner who's either ignorant or hostile.
Okay, well, that's not going to work well, is it? Do you have them come in who are dealing with erectile issues because of medications?
Oh, sure.
I'm seeing more of that.
But they tend to be the older guys.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I suppose, yeah, there are some younger guys who are on SSRIs for depression, and that can affect their erections.
But the
older guys often are on blood pressure medicine, and that contributes to ED.
Right. I am also hearing of couples where, as a result of taking Ritalin or Adderall through college, that their study buddies, that has impacted their ability to maintain erections and keep them. And then what happens is the woman has the feeling of, oh my gosh, I'm not desirable. He's not interested in me. When in all actuality, it's because he cannot maintain an erection because his system has literally been, in essence, rewired.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm not sure what to recommend for these people.
And some of the women who've been on birth control for a long time, it's the same thing. Their libidos are affected.
Particularly if it's the type that they refer to as being beautifying, meaning it's an androgen blocker. So it stops the breakout from the hormonal spikes, and that is generic name for it is Ocella, and we'll think of the name for too, but very popular, and it does. It wipes out their libidos. If you're blocking the androgens, if you're blocking the testosterone production, you're blocking the sex drive.
Mm-hmm.
And women have a small enough amount of testosterone as it is. And, right. Oh, Yaz and Yasmin, that's the name of the...
Oh, yes, Yaz, yes. Good.
Those are the two.
Yeah.
And so their generic name is Ocella.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking at, you know, I just got a call from, did you ever meet Tom Stewart with Sports Sheets?
I don't think so.
Because he called today and was wanting, he's wanting to look into the area of specifically older sex, things that, because that is such a growing area of interest. And I would think that, you know, you have a lot of people coming now who are saying, look, how can I fine-tune something? How can I tweak something?
Absolutely, and people are living longer, and a lot of the people that are now in their 60s came up when it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and they don't want to easily give up the sex.
No.
And the drugs have changed for some older people into these SSRIs instead of marijuana or whatever. But people don't, they often had a robust sex life back then, and then if it starts to slip, they don't want to give that up, and they're staying healthier longer, and I've always had,
they may change partners, and they want to have something new and fresh.
Yes, and that was actually part of my PhD dissertation, and that goes back to something you said a while ago, that I was looking at older women in new relationships, and because I was in Hawaii at the time, I was looking at Asian women married to Caucasian men, and there was that little aspect to it. But it turned out that the women that answered my questionnaire and all that, that they often had better sex with new partners. Well, that's not so surprising, but they also had more privacy. Their kids were launched. You know, I talk about ideally the empty nest becomes the love nest. And when we have a new partner, there's more novelty and more increase of dopamine from the brain, which is the hormone of arousal. So women were often having better sex when they had a new partner after a divorce or after being widowed.
And it wasn't the same thing again and again. I think we're about to do our wrap-up here, my dear.
Oh, my goodness. You're right. Yeah, you're a radio pro. Thank you, Lou. I'll be in touch with you for our part two. And I'll be on your show Monday. Thank you, Lou, so much. Bye-bye. Labirinto di un amaro autore, ma i tuoi piedi cadono.